to pick on big tech in these days, I come at it at a little bit of a different lens. I mean, I think companies make major mistakes, and I think they should be held accountable. And I think one of the great things, particularly about companies in America, is that you have an opportunity to self-correct, or you'll pay a price in the market for not doing it. I think at the same time, we shouldn't underestimate the power of what big tech has unleashed around the world.
Despite pandemic headwinds, these are the headlines. Startups are thriving, venture capitalists are booming, with global venture funding exceeding the dot-com era at $300 billion last year. That growth came as industries disrupted by the pandemic, from work, healthcare, education, finance, shopping, and entertainment, shifted dramatically to online services, which further created a boom for a strong IPO and M&A market. The bottom line, the global entrepreneurial revolution is here. And who better to unpack this than my next guest, renowned American investor, advisor, and author Christopher Schroeder, who has seen this firsthand in some of the most unexpected places. Chris is the co-founder of Next Billion Ventures, focused on the next billion digital consumers across global emerging markets, and is also a network partner for Village Global, an early VC fund backed by, among others, Bill Gates, Sarah Blakely, and Jeff Bezos. He sits on the investment committees of Wanda Capital and Saudi Telecom Ventures, and that, my friends, is just the tip of the iceberg. Chris started out in politics with the George W. Bush presidential campaign before becoming the CEO of the Washington Post Newsweek Interactive. He then co-founded Health Central, backed by the likes of Sequoia, and Carlyle before it was acquired in 2012. In 2013, Chris published Startup Rising, the entrepreneurial revolution remaking the Middle East, with a foreword by Mark Andreessen. Today, we unpack the rise of startups through this crisis, solving for some of the toughest problems. You don't want to miss this. Welcome to Billion Dollar Moves, the show for the top US and Asia founders, funders, and execs making billion dollar moves that are shaping our future. From the growing pains of a unicorn journey to IPO, the question of impact and returns, to scaling a venture capital firm, we go real deep in the world of venture and business. I'm your host, Sarah Chen. Now let's get started.
It's been a minute since we hung out, but as I was saying earlier, you know, behind stage, it's going to be a challenge, I think, today for us with 30 minutes, because there's just so much depth that I think we've always covered in our conversations. And, you know, today we want to talk about a topic that you love and you're so passionate about, and I think has truly been your mission, which is the global entrepreneurial revolution. So let's get started. You know, Billion Dollar Moves is really a little bit about some of the top trends that are happening right now in the world. But beyond that, we also want to have a look beyond the individual that's wearing the hat of the funder and the founder and the exec. And today we want to find out about your billion dollar moves. I mean, you've had such an extraordinary career, from politics to being an executive and then having an exit and now funding companies you believe in. Tell us about what got you here and who Christopher Schroeder is.
I mean, that's a hard question, I think, to answer in a quick synopsis, but I like to think of myself first and foremost of service. I think throughout my career, whether I was running companies or whether I was been doing the investment, which is tantamount really to being a mentor and advisor to so many entrepreneurs around the world, I'm thinking, how can I make people actualize their vision? How can I make them achieve the dreams? When I ran WashingtonPost.com, to me, it was how could people get information in the most accessible way so they can make the best decisions in their lives. I built a company called Health Central that was to empower people to have their choice in how they were taking control of their health lives. And now when I spend time with literally thousands of entrepreneurs around the world, every woman and man has something in their teeth that they want to solve. And I hope some of my experience and some of the things I've went through, and certainly the mistakes I've made, can be helpful to them.
So tell me, which is your favorite chapter so far?
Oh, I've loved every chapter. I don't think there's, I mean, everything is a different pain points. Everything has different excitement about it and everything else. So I don't think there's one that's been the favorite chapter. I think there are moments that are shared in the sine wave, which is life. And I think it's right when you really sort of realize you've got it, that that is an incredibly high moment, that you've really gotten people together to make something happen and it actually happens. You've actually built something that wasn't there before. Throughout my career, those are the moments that have been the highlights.
And I know you did an interview recently about sort of your transition, you know, where the interviewer asked you about your transition into entrepreneurship. And, you know, I ask this a lot with the founders that we work with, whether you think a founder, that bug of entrepreneurship is something that you're sort of born with or you cultivate? And is that something that you felt with yourself as, you know, something that was innate within you, that you were first and foremost an entrepreneur despite all the different chapters that you've had?
I think in reflection, I was entrepreneurial. I was always looking for new ways to think about the world, almost in an iconoclastic way. When people mm-hmm. were sort of conventionally believing something was true, I would want to unpack it and understand it and see if there's new opportunity. And as a kid, I did many entrepreneurial things, including in a very different time and in a very different way. I had a little DJ business, which ended up actually failing incredibly. But also at the same time, I did things which were fairly established. I mean, in a way, when I was at the Washington Post, I was an intrapreneur, not an entrepreneur. We were a very entrepreneurial organization, but within a very large media company. And I had actually adjustments to become an entrepreneur again. When I spun out from that and you know, co-authored a new company with a bunch of other people, there was musculature I had to get back that I think I didn't quite have when I was in a more comfortable, a more entrepreneurial environment.
That's interesting that you mentioned that. And I know, you know, we've talked a little bit about this as well. Your shift to becoming CEO of Health Central wasn't necessarily your strongest first few years. And, you know, as you said, I think there was a little bit of a muscle that you needed to rework there. But talk to us a little bit about that shift. I mean, a lot of entrepreneurs today are, in fact, you know, exiting from their corporate jobs. And it has become to some aspect a necessity as well. Do you think that's something that, you know, you sort of picked up through action and learning along the way? Or was there something specific that you did for the transition?
You know, you touched on a very true point. I see a lot of young people now who are pitching me now who are doing startups, and they've come out of places like McKinsey and Bain or maybe large corporations. And sometimes there's a lot of musculature that comes from that experience, which is very powerful. So, for example, in the Middle East and now in Pakistan and elsewhere, I'm seeing a whole slew of entrepreneurs who sort of cut their teeth working in what became of a very large company called Careem, which is the largest ride-sharing company there that got bought by Uber for over $3 billion. And in a way, that experience as entrepreneurs was very useful because they actually saw how to scale up a company. They learned sort of the vicissitudes of things that can go wrong and how you adjust to them. And that was very good learning. I think sometimes in other circumstances, you come from a big situation, you're comfortable with your brand, you're comfortable with the amount of money that you're making and all, and it is an adjustment. And I think in some respects, in my own case, coming from this, you know, amazing large media company, to being off on my own, I don't think my first year was my best year. I think I became the entrepreneur that I did become. But I think in many ways, my first year was an adjustment to rethink about things and to get some of that hunger and tenacity and perseverance back, that no matter how entrepreneurial you are in a large organization, if you have a brand, if you have a balance sheet, you have an element of security, people will answer your phone calls, that is jarring when you then decide that you're going to do it completely on your own. But you get there. If you really want it in your teeth, you figure it out.
And what was that learning for you in terms of, you know, being able to shift from the, you know, I guess the security, right? And being able to then go out on your own. Was there something specific that you addressed in the way that you led the company, the way that you thought about the journey?
You know, I think firstly, there was an adjustment just in humility, frankly. I mean, you just sort of get that there are going to be people who get you and understand you, and then they're really willing to help you. And there are going to be a lot of people who thought about you in a different way when you had a certain brand behind you. And there's a little bit of a sifting exercise in terms of the talent that you recruit. There are people who are also great in an entrepreneurial opportunity and, you know, maybe weren't as good in an entrepreneurial venture. And so some of it was just humility. But what was the most essential thing that I did was I surrounded myself with what was effectively a personal board of advisors of actually some of the leading startup entrepreneurs and venture capitalists in the country that just were friends of mine. And I relied on them heavily. And I asked a lot of questions. I did a lot of reporting. I interviewed CEOs who I felt had done it well. And these women and men were absolutely essential for me to sort of reground myself and prioritize better. And then success began to breed success.
Right. And, you know, you bring an important point, and I want to go then into the topic of the day, which is the global entrepreneurial revolution that you know, we want to spend some time on. But you brought up the fact of just how founders have to think differently and you know, have that sense of humility. And now you're in the next chapter of being an investor and advisor where it's less hands-on. I know some VCs, you know, including Gary Tan from Initialized, sometimes says, you know, he misses that hands dirty, you know, getting into the rough of trying to then build and create. How then did you shift now into investments? And do you feel you're a better investor, VC, than you are a founder?
I completely empathize with Gary's comment. There are a lot of times I'm sitting with an entrepreneur and I think to myself, I'd love to be, you know, on the ground doing it again. You know, quite often, I will tell you, there are times I get 2 o'clock in the morning, panicked phone calls, and I help the entrepreneur think through what she's wrestling. And then at 2:15, right, I can go back to bed and she can't. And that sometimes is a reminder to me that, you know, their different things have their pluses and their minuses overall. I will tell you that I just love the pattern recognition that has developed, and particularly, you know, with Next Billion Ventures and the things I do with Village Global and Andreessen and others, this sort of dashboard of a rising new globalism that I get to see through the eyes of entrepreneurs is very stimulating. But also, it gives me this, as I said before, a pattern recognition of how the world is changing, how different people are dealing with different circumstances. And I can see that value in the eyes of the entrepreneurs when I sit down with them and talk through what their issues are and give them, you know, some ideas of what other people are doing. One of the things I love to do is bring entrepreneurs together from around the world who may be in very different businesses, but they may be navigating a similar product, say in influence marketing or something like that. And all of a sudden, you'll have a couple of young people from Africa, Southeast Asia, and Latin America, and maybe one from Silicon Valley, all on a Zoom. And they're just completely brainstorming really innovative ways to handle a similar problem. And I must say, I love that stuff, Sarah. That's been terrific.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, they're all thankful for just the strategic thinking that you bring to the table that I think is, frankly, really one of your strongest suits in asking. You know, you always ask me the hard questions, and I'm sure you do that for everyone as well. And, you know, it's truly, I think sometimes it's about really having that curiosity, right? As an investor, I think sometimes there's so much about how the VC is, you know, God and King, but you know, people forget the reality is we're in business because of the entrepreneurs, because of their great ideas and the innovation, and we're here to support it. So I want to talk a little bit about this phenomenon, which you brought up with that sort of the Zoom call and how all entrepreneurs come to the table with almost a lingua franca, that is entrepreneurship, a shared language of entrepreneurship. And this is happening globally. What are you seeing right now? You know, paint a little bit of a landscape right now of why we think, and you've called this out long before, right? The global entrepreneurial revolution. Paint a bit of a landscape here for us.
You know, I had a first aha moment of sorts of this probably 7 or 8 years ago with Mike Moritz, who's the head of Sequoia, who's also an investor in my last company. We were having a conversation a little bit about this. And Sequoia is one of the few venture capital funds from Silicon Valley who have deep presences in the global environment. And he told me, and he in fact used the term lingua franca, he said, when I sit in a room with entrepreneurs, no matter wherever they are kind of the same people. You can see the same look in their eye. If you throw a problem at it, you can see them sort of generate how they're going to come at it and how they're going to think about it. They share many experiences and approaches in the way they do that. And what has been compounded in what I've seen now in the last, you know, 8 years of traveling 250,000 miles a year and now on Zoom is a kind of an addendum to that. And that is what I have found is that I can meet entrepreneurs in any rising market. And it doesn't matter if they're in Jakarta or in Sao Paulo or Cairo, for all that is different culturally, historically, geographically, if they're in the same sector or wrestling similar things, 70% of what they're thinking about is unbelievably similar. And they're navigating things in that 70% that, frankly, my sisters and brothers in Silicon Valley aren't thinking about. You know, how do you navigate last mile logistics if addresses are uncertain? How do you navigate regulatory environments that may change all the time? How do you bring people into financial inclusion if they've never had a credit card or a bank account before? And as you talk to people around the world, it is another element of that lingua franca, as you describe it, which is they know this experience. They understand this. They have ideas about how to navigate it. And it's not that my friends in the Valley don't sort of understand it. And certainly the new generation, it's very global, understand it, but they don't live it. And they're not trying to solve those problems, whereas these entrepreneurs really are.
And are you seeing the same? I mean, you know, one of the key things that has become very real in this time of a pandemic, and, you know, the headlines was that despite what we thought was going to be a rough couple of, you know, few months or even leading up to a year, startups actually are thriving and venture capitalists are throwing money at startups. We've seen some of the biggest IPOs, the trend of SPACs and all these things coming to the fore here. What are you seeing across the globe? Is this something, you know, as we talk about the lingua franca and this, you know, just the burst of everything that's coming together, do you see this happening equally throughout the world of this rise of just startups?
What's happening equally, and then there's a little bit that's a bit unequal, as you can imagine, but what is equally happening, and I think this has been driven very much by COVID, it's almost become a cliche to say it now, is acceleration. It is the idea that 5, 7, 10 years of behavior, pick whatever favorite number you have, has been jammed into about 4 or 5 months. because people around the world have compelled to buy things online. The people who are serving in e-commerce have had to find logistics to be able to deliver things that have been ordered online. Folks, again, who have never had a credit card before have to figure out how to navigate mobile payments. Obviously, everyone is taking classes online. People are seeking medical attention online. And many, many people who weren't that comfortable with it now have sort of been rocketed into that comfort. And that's fairly universal. And this has had a major effect on a lot of entrepreneurs, at least in certain sectors, of really thriving, in fact, performing much greater than they ever did before. And I think it has woken up a lot of the Western world to start looking at other parts of the world that they haven't focused as much in before because of that. The corollary, though, to that is that there is absolutely an unequalness, because I'm incredibly enthusiastic at the amount of access to technology that much of the world has. 80% of humanity who has a mobile device now has a supercomputer in their pocket, a smartphone, literally more computing in their pocket than all of NASA had to put a man on the moon 40 years, 50 years ago. But 2-3 billion people on the planet have none of it at all. And I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind, for all the enthusiasm of what's happening, that we used to talk about digital divide as kind of a nice thing to talk about. For me, it's now become an essential thing. It is the determinant of whether or not individuals and countries will be competitive in the 21st century or not to be able to get this access going. That will be opportunity for entrepreneurs, but it also is causing some of the unevenness that you asked about before.
Right. And what do you think is this something that entrepreneurs should be thinking about? I mean, one of the key things that we are passionate about is seeing the impact that a lot of entrepreneurs continue to make. Just also part of it is their personal mission. Are you seeing impact, sustainability, the task of wanting to address this inequity being something that entrepreneurs today are saying, yep, I'm going to do something about it. This is, I'm not here to go into hyper growth and create yet another app that's for growth sake, but I'm here to make an impact. Are you seeing a shift in terms of the purpose and the mission of entrepreneurship?
I think for some period of time, and it was even the case in my own startup, I rarely meet an entrepreneur who does not have some problem in her teeth that she really wants to solve, something in her backyard or some experience that she has that she doesn't see some opportunity to create something very powerful. And, I think a lot of times investors get very hung up on this idea that there's something called an impact investment and something called a for-profit investment. And I think the Venn diagram between the two is extremely tight. I mean, having said that, there's some problems, and this is an example of it, in digital divide, which may not have a clear business model, may not have a venture capital-like return in a portfolio. And that means that there are going to have to be alternative sources of capital that are invested in that. But the fact of the matter is things like the digital divide are huge in infrastructure challenges, and they also run into the teeth of regulation. So this is one of the, while the entrepreneurial experience that we're talking about is a very bottom-up experience, this is one of these places where the top-down matters. Government and policymakers have to get their acts together. Major providers of infrastructure, from mobile carriers down to literally the people who are laying fiber and so on, have to really think we've got to figure this out as a opportunity. And again, lots of different major players like Google and Facebook and others have leaned into this to try to be helpful to it. But there's just clearly a lot of work to do. And it's very clear coming out of COVID that the urgency is greater than ever before.
Yeah. And, I'm jumping a little bit here, but you picked on something, which is the bottom up and the top down approach, which is something that I think about often. Coming from Malaysia, an emerging economy, developing economies where government did play a role in starting up the ecosystem, right? We didn't have Silicon Valley immediately. It took time. Even in Singapore, there was a lot of initial government investment into VC firms, into then startup entrepreneurship and so on and so forth. And my question to you then, and I know you've thought about this a little bit as well, is what is the role of government in entrepreneurship? And you brought up two key names that I also want to get your thoughts on, which is Google and Facebook, and the role of big tech and government, which is hot today. What are your thoughts here?
Well, look, there's a kind of a, if not a myth, a conventional wisdom that comes out of American entrepreneurs in particular. And I think there's been a huge element of this in the Valley for 20 years, which is the best thing the government can do is kind of get out of the way, let innovation do what it wants to do. And I have a leaning towards that in many ways. Having said that, the irony is, of anyone who understands the history of Silicon Valley, the government played a lot of role in unleashing that innovation 50 years ago and going forward, from funding and DARPA and R&D and other things like that. Right. But that doesn't mean that they're wrong. I mean, at the end of the day, the ability to have policy whose focus is to allow talent to succeed and to unleash with the least amount of friction the ideas that she or he has to develop, I think is sort of the foundational mark of how, at the end of the day, policymakers can be thinking about this. Are you making an entrepreneur's life better, easier, faster, cheaper, more beautiful, more efficient? Are you allowing investment money to be able to flow fairly easily? And of course, investors are able to get money out of the circumstances. I mean, there's some very basic things that in this amazing global world, that if certain governments and if certain countries don't get it right, capital and talent will simply go somewhere else. And then you have a cycle of this sort of brain drain and capital drain whose future is completely easy to predict. And so I do believe that there's a role of government. I do believe we have examples in many parts of the world that often make us in America uncomfortable where the government has been constructive. I think there are people who believe in those countries you cannot have innovation because you cannot have centrally planned innovation. But I think people who are thinking that way have a view of central planned economies from maybe 20 or 30 years ago. They're not thinking about how there's been more of an ability to allow and unleash talent on its own sake. I still think there are many limitations and there are many problems that these countries also have to stare at and rethink. Often they talk a better game than they act. But it's a complicated world. It doesn't lend itself to one simple answer. And your observation, you know, on Facebook and what have you, you know, it has been very fun to pick on big tech in these days. I come at it at a little bit of a different lens. I mean, I think companies make major mistakes and I think they should be held accountable. And I think one of the great things, particularly about companies in America, is that you have an opportunity to self-correct or you'll pay a price in the market for not doing it. I think at the same time, we shouldn't underestimate the power of what big tech has unleashed around the world. And I have to tell you, I've spent some time recently really focusing on India and I've seen this in Latin America and Brazil. I mean, WhatsApp is a revolution for small businesses and individuals, not only to connect in the way that you and I do commonly, but to literally do transactions, to build business, to reach customers. I mean, the only problem I think with WhatsApp is I don't think they understand how their tools are actually being used in rising markets. If they did, they would adjust the product to make it easier for them because most of the women and men are jerry-rigging the product to make it work, but they're making it work by the millions and they're reaching customers and transacting things by the millions. You can't simply look at big tech and say they're all bad when tools like this have unleashed this level of potential and multiplier outcome in so many places in the world.
Right. But what is the balance here, though? I mean, you know, sure, I think you know, there's definitely good that has come of tech. And I think we have to be believers in tech. But Facebook, Google, Amazon have grown to become monopolies in many ways. And with even the political climate, I think there's a lot of discussion on what is the limit and how do markets really self-correct when the monopoly is so intense?
I think it's an incredibly important question. And I've thought about it a lot in different contexts. I was in China a year and 3 months ago, and I sort of came away from these amazing meetings with Tencent and Alibaba and others and thinking to myself, well, there's just no way anyone can compete with these juggernauts. Like they are so large, they have so much capital, they have so much talent, they have so much data, they can simply launch products with incredible efficacy and they could do it for free. Having said that, TikTok rose. Having said that, Pinduoduo completely rose, doing something very innovative and different in the way that they did in e-commerce and what audiences they went at. So, you know, innovation is a very kind of sticky, complicated thing where even in light of big juggernauts, the great companies have come in and disrupted them. Having said that, I do have some worry now, not so much about the traditional sense of antitrust, which is our consumers being hurt by pricing, because the fact of the matter is most of these platforms are incredibly price efficient and many of them are even free. And we have to keep in mind that Amazon is a juggernaut, but e-commerce still only represents about 16% of all retail sales in the United States. It's like 2% in most of the other places of the world. So you need to rethink what that definition is. What public good are you trying to get at? And the string that I will continue to pull on is the idea that the juggernauts may suck out the ability of innovation to rise. That to me is problematic. But on the other hand, I don't think I've got a lot of data proving it. I think I still see amazing companies that are innovating. They often get acquired by some of these larger companies. And I've never been more bullish on the era of innovation that we're living in right now. So I think we have to ask these questions because they're important. We have to look at the data because they're real. But I think what often happens, particularly in American politics, is the fact that something is large inherently means it's a problem. And I think that's only one string to pull on. There's no nuance in that. It's a simple politically expedient thing. And it's not getting to the essence of what is it that we want? What is the vision that we're building to? What is the environment regulatorily? To what end do we wish us to be? And I feel that that part of the argument often is lost.
Right. And you know, I want to go into what else you're seeing as well. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, what we've seen in the last couple of years, and you talk about the era of innovation, right, with the rise of so many interesting solutions. But having said that, you know, in Southeast Asia, I mean, Grab just announced a huge spec deal. You know, you talk a lot about the Careem effect, which follows, you know, for viewers, the PayPal effect, which is once a startup, you know, does really well, the founders, the founding team go on to spin off and do similarly amazing things. You know, people like Elon Musk, who's created basically everything else under the sun, the folks under a firm as well. And it's happening as well in the Middle East, which I want to get to. But it seems to be, you know, more of the same super apps. Just applied in different localities. Didi is also going for an IPO, and that's a version of Uber. Are we really seeing innovation across the globe, or is it just copycat models?
I have friends in Silicon Valley who think that we don't, and that it is still an era of copycat and that real innovation. Like, I mean, there's a reason why America came up with two vaccines in 10 months, which has never happened in the history of the world, even close to it. And they think there's a big difference. I have a broader definition of innovation, because I think that if you have millions of people with supercomputers in the pockets for the first time, and they are beginning to explore and invent with those products to sell off hyperly local products, it's problems. These are incredible innovation. I've invested, the MBV team has invested in several B2B marketplaces around the world. This is literally taking highly fragmented retail mom and pop shops and allowing them to have platforms where, one, they can help sell goods with greater efficacy, but secondly, with the data, they can actually become good borrowers and credit is available to them. 90% of retail sales are sold this way in most of the world, as opposed to what we're used to in the West. Don't tell me that these folks who are building these marketplaces and figuring out very interesting ways in very local terms are not innovators. And I'll tell you, I had a very interesting conversation on Clubhouse with Mudas Sirshika, who is one of the co-founders of Careem, and they are moving down the path of a super app. And I said, so you must have studied Grab to really understand how it happens. He said, look, we're aware of Grab. We certainly know what other people have done in China and elsewhere. He said, but I get up in the morning, go to bed at night thinking, what innovation is actually most relevant to the markets that I'm in, from Saudi Arabia to Pakistan? And that doesn't mean there aren't lessons from Grab, but I'm not a copycat of Grab. I am literally thinking about the best application and product on the terms of the audience that I wish to serve. And I think we need to keep that in mind when people are sort of, you know, dismissive of this idea that people are merely taking ideas that worked before. Why wouldn't you take a great idea and build upon it? All music is based on that. All literature is based on that. I don't understand why people don't look at that still as innovation. I mean, there's absolutely no question that Hemingway was inspired by previous authors. That doesn't take away from the innovation in his writing. It's not much different to me in technology.
Absolutely. And well, I mean, to the point of localization and really addressing what's real, there is a reason why Didi did better than Uber, and why, you know, the fact of just the copycat models across the globe, why Grab still exists, right, in terms of really catering to the Southeast Asian market and the understanding there. So talk to me a little bit about then your interest. I think you mentioned Careem, and then, you know, you wrote a book about the revolution, the entrepreneur revolution in the Middle East. What was it that got you started on that path?
You know, I have a long sort of historical and passion about many parts of the world, but the Middle East and its history of antiquity and the rise of Islam has been very interesting to me. I'd been there as a tourist many times. But it really was almost 10 years ago today, just at the cusp of the beginning of the Arab uprising, that a couple of people who really were the kind of leaders of the tech ecosystem in the Arab world started telling me, you know, you and guys in America, you have one narrative about what's happening over here. You worry about all the doom and disaster and crisis, and you get yourselves involved and mess it up in your own way. But you got to understand the new generation has access to technology, and they're doing unbelievable things. And I went to the first major gathering of startups in the Arab world in 2010, in the late fall. And I knew within 3 hours that my life had changed completely, because not only were these 3,500 young people with a 3,500 person waiting list unbelievably interesting from all over the world, they didn't care about politics, they were looking to solve problems in powerful ways. But it was clear to me that they were representative of a trend that to me is one of the biggest questions of our era, which we sort of started this conversation with. How does society, how does business, how does economics, how does innovation change when everyone bottom up has access to supercomputing? And so the Middle East in and of itself was a shock to my narrative bias, and it took me into a very new version of understanding it. But in many ways, it was a complete platform of understanding a much larger global shift of which it's a part of.
And now beyond that, years later, after the book, you've gone on to explore to different emerging markets from Latin America to Southeast Asia as well. Tell us about what's exciting you. What are the new technologies that, you know, and some of the toughest problems that these entrepreneurs are solving?
Well, in a way, it's the toughest problems I love the most. I mean, I think there are some investors who like to look at things where, you know, it's kind of an only a software solution and it may sort of scale out. But I love, like in the B2B marketplace example I gave you before, entrepreneurs who are looking at a massive local problem that has a lot of fragmentation. There's a lot of hands dirty stuff. You got to get right on the ground. If you don't get it right, it doesn't matter. But if you do and you layer on data science and technology, you can then scale it and end the fragmentation and then allow these other businesses or other individuals to do things they couldn't do before. I think the biggest revolution of our era right now is that we are doing massive financial inclusion to a point where that almost any company of size with a lot of data is becoming a fintech company. Because if you are in e-commerce or if you are in a ride sharing or if you have anything about data of consumers and businesses and how they transact, you can begin to predict whether or not they're a good credit risk in a way that credit bureaus never have been able to do it before. And this to me is a revolution because I'm seeing more and more businesses, not only like Pinduoduo in China, but it's also like Fastly in Brazil and others, which are saying, look, we're going to not work on the bottom half of the pyramid because it's a good thing to do, though it is. We're going to do it because they're dying to be unleashed. And now they have the tools to be unleashed. And other people are not going to focus on them. We will, on their terms. And This is something which is extremely exciting and quite universal across these markets.
Love it. So definitely embedded finance. I think we're definitely seeing that across. And just to take us home here, you know, you work with a lot of founders. You've been a founder yourself in terms of the journey that you've been through. What would your advice be for founders at this stage?
You know, there's something that you said almost parenthetically, which is true and is a cautionary note. I think a lot of founders are intimidated by money. One of the benefits of this go-go era that I'm really unnerving to me right now, I think the valuations are getting quite frothy, and that's not just problematic to me as an investor, but I worry about the performance that will justify it over time. But having said that, at least it's allowed a lot of power in the hands of entrepreneurs to not be intimidated by money. But I see this all the time where entrepreneurs think, this woman is very wealthy or she's working for a well-branded firm. They must know everything. But in point of fact, the entrepreneurs invariably know tenfold of what an investor knows. And the investor may have very good pattern recognition. And if she's any good, she'll be an incredible mentor and opener of doors because of that pattern recognition. But no one understands a problem in their teeth like the entrepreneur. And sometimes I tell them, you know, perseverance is the greatest asset you can have after your integrity as an entrepreneur. But part and parcel of perseverance is not to be intimidated by naysayers around you or people who think they're bigger than you just because they've either made money or done something else. You know, keep to your North Star, listen to data that might make you want to adjust your path to it, but don't be intimidated by people around you who are trying to tell you they know more than you do because often they do not.
Love it. And as we wrap up, thoughts as we're getting to the end of the tunnel here with the pandemic, with vaccines inside and all of the above, but still rising cases, what are your thoughts on what's next for the coming months and looking into the year?
I think that there's a three things I would say. One is I think we should be humble as we've ever been. We all have this release and we want to be out and we want to be doing things as we did them before. But I think we should be humble because we don't know how this thing will play out. And we should be conscious and sensitive to people around us in doing that. I think secondly, there will be a massive temptation, and you'll see many of the pundits in the press talking about we're going to come back. In some respects, we will come back. We're dying to do things that we did before. We love travel, go to bars or whatever. But I think one of the most interesting questions is the question of back to what? President Biden talks often about America is back. It's a very, very different world in some ways. Things are changing in foundational ways that we have to stop and breathe a little bit. History will tell us what those changes were. But right now, as we think about the rise of cryptocurrencies, not only in an individual way like Bitcoin, but what's happening now with China releasing their own, as we look at NFT, if we look at a lot of other things that are happening, people are expressing, and a new generation is expressing, they want something, I think, structurally different. And I think we should be thinking about that and interpreting how we can lean into that, again, with innovation and entrepreneurship, to offer different kinds of solutions that can be very constructive into the complicated and often problematic world we're in.
Well, Chris, you know, this was a short half an hour that we had to really run through the global entrepreneurial revolution, your personal journey. And I think we've really covered a lot of bases. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for spending time with us here and your leadership.
It's great to be here, Sarah. And thanks for your leadership.
This is the post-show discussion with Christopher Schroeder, investor, entrepreneur and really with a keen interest in emerging markets and what's next in the global entrepreneurial revolution. Max, I know you had a comment, a question, and over to you after that, Stephanie. And of course, anyone else who wants to come to the stage, please raise your hands and we will be bringing you up.
Sure. Hey, yeah, really, really enjoyed that interview. But I wanted to talk again about creativity and agree with something you said about how no idea, everything's kind of an idea of an idea. And no idea, and I was agreeing that no idea is truly original. It's just a combination of other ideas that are built upon each other. It almost goes into that creativity conversation where even Steve Jobs says all ideas are, you know, all creativity is just connecting older ideas and putting them together. And so I thought that I was agreeing with you. I thought that was really, really good. And another thing you were talking about is the supercomputers in everybody's pockets and how that's really speeding up innovation. And it goes back to when I think about human evolution and how ideas, you know, they grow and they spread when people come together and because they share them. And so ideas, you know, they grow faster in bigger cities because more people are there and there are more people to spread them. And now, because of technology and how people are coming together, ideas are being able to spread more easily. And that way, and because of that, innovation is happening at a quicker pace. So, more just adding on in and agreeing with everything you were saying. So, really enjoyed that.
Thanks, Max. And Kalsum, did you have a question for Chris as well? I know we talk to him all the time, but any interesting thoughts?
No, I do. I always have questions for Chris. So one question for you, Chris. I mean, I feel like we've looked at stuff together. You know, you're looking at Foxconn, but you're looking across the world. And I feel like you look at a lot of similar things. But I'm curious, like, what are the things that for you, because obviously there's always the nuances of a certain country. And so for you, what matters to you when you're looking at a country for the first time or when you're looking at, like, what are the things that you look for nuance-wise? If you're looking at a model that might be similar to, like, what you've done in Mexico as an example, like, what would you look at that might be different from a nuance perspective to ensure you're making the right call in a market that you may not be as familiar with?
You know, I think all of us have our pattern recognition, right? We all have things that we've experienced that we've found effective in some places, and we may start by having questions of saying, are there similarities here? Are there differences here? And where may they be overall? The problem with that pattern recognition is it becomes very quickly narrative biased. So you can slowly start to convince yourself, particularly if you've had one or two successes somewhere, that this must work anywhere. And then you blind yourself to the nuance. And what I have found in going to all these different parts of the world, that all the detail is in the nuance. And so, for instance, I don't invest, we at MBV do not invest unless we're side by side with some people, women and men that we really trust on the ground. We have venture partners on the ground, but also we will only invest side by side with people. I've never looked at a Pakistan deal, Cals, without pinging you and asking you if you'd heard of them or know about it. And then you and I would have very rich discussions about the nuance of going on, not just to Pakistan writ large, but what are people doing different in Lahore than they might doing in Karachi and whatever. It becomes a massive listening exercise that at one point, you know, some combination of that humility, some combination of looking for trends that you're familiar with and then finding out where there may be differences. And that differences could be in the regulatory environment. The differences could be simply culturally. The differences could be in infrastructure. There are usually many, many differences. You then start to ask yourself, okay, how are those entrepreneurs navigating those differences? There's a great moment we talked about in the video conference I recently was on a clubhouse with Mudassir Sheikha, who, you know, is one of the great co-founders of Careem, the great ride-sharing company that was bought by Uber for over $3 billion in the Middle East. And he's has a vision. He's got a plan now, a very creative plan, about how he's going to go into what's pretty close to the super app business. They're in payments now, but they want to offer a lot of things. And I asked him, I said, so obviously you're looking at the Grab playbook. And he almost cut me off before I finished my sentence and said, look, obviously, we're aware of Grab. Obviously, we're aware of Alibaba and Tencent, and we're aware of where super apps have happened. But I get up in the morning, go to bed at night, thinking about what's different about my market. How can I serve my customers on their terms with some shared understanding of what people have done elsewhere? But I get up in the morning and go to bed at night thinking about what I can do. And when you stop and think about it, that's why Careem got on the map versus Uber. Like in the old American playbook, all Uber was supposed to have done is showed up anywhere in the world with a lot of money, a lot of technology, a lot of Silicon Valley vibe, a lot of data, and they should win anywhere, right? Like Instagram, WhatsApp, wherever it went, it sort of won. And a lot of Americans think that's the way. But what Mudassir and his team understood was that the nuance is everything. And when they started offering ride sharing on the terms of their customers, And Uber assumed those customers would behave like other Uber customers. This is where all of a sudden things began to divide, and why, for all intents and purposes, Uber had no choice but to buy them at a fortune because they couldn't beat them. And so I really do try to understand, and I'm very impressed by the women and men who explain to me what's different about their markets and how they are delighting their customers on their terms and using technology as a way to scale it. And so that's the way that I kind of navigate it.
So, Chris, that actually makes me think of a perspective on examining uncertainty. And one of the key things that I find with some even LPs that are investing into funds, right? It's you know, they don't have exposure to the new market. They're unsure of not just the growth of a certain vertical, but even just the political uncertainty, the geographic risk there, geopolitical risk there. How do you think about, as Carlson said, you know, entering a new market where, frankly, in certain places, including, you know, Southeast Asia, where it still is opaque in some places, there is still a lot of corruption. How do you think about that, especially where startups these days are solving problems that require working with regulation?
You know, it sometimes becomes tempting to tease a little bit. You know, I'll use America as an example, like American LPs or Western LPs, or even venture capital funds that have, at least before COVID, get up in the morning, go to bed at night, wanting to invest 50 miles from Sand Hill Road. And, you know, you can only mock that so much, because the fact of the matter is, for decades, it's been unbelievably successful. And the physical network effect of talent in Silicon Valley is unarguable. And there's incredible opportunity, and there's great rule of law, and a lot of other dynamics that are very important. I think that with that comes a discomfort, but a learning comfort, that incredible things are happening now everywhere, because so much of this technology is in everyone's hands. But what then happens is that new narrative bias will kick in. I can't tell you the number of investors I've talked to who will say, you know, I lost my ass in Brazil 20 years ago. Why is it possibly different now? And I say to them, are you kidding me? 20 years ago? What are you talking about? Have you heard of Nubank? Have you heard of Mercado Libre, which is now worth over $70 billion as a publicly traded company and the largest e-commerce and payments company in Latin America? Have you heard about Rappi? Have you seen all these entrepreneurs in a new generation coming? This isn't some ethereal exercise. There are now entrepreneurs who understand this localness that Kasum was talking about and Marina was talking about before. They understand this localness. They understand how to navigate the issues. Now what you have to do is stop thinking about Western companies showing up and winning. You have to think about co-authorship. You have to think, how can I get this opportunity by working closely with people who simply understand things that I don't, that I can bring a lot to the table from what I know, but there's no one sitting around waiting for my answers. They're waiting to really see what have you done, which we can understand, and what do we do that you don't understand? And that is a very different kind of investor mindset. But I will say that one of the beauties about all that we've been talking about has a curse embedded in it. And that is, because opportunity is anywhere and because talent is everywhere, it does mean investors can pick and choose. And this is incumbent, I think, on governments around the world to start making a decision for the 21st century. Are we, in fact, doing what we can to unleash these women and men who are building things that were never there before? Are we taking it seriously, or is this some kind of lip service, you know, ribbon-cutting exercise? Are we really rethinking regulation to unleash this innovation in very powerful ways, not on some old legacy system, but based on what is actually needed for 21st century expansive needs? And corruption weighs like a cancer on that. And a lot of historical paradigms. I mean, many of these countries are still in the hands of people in their 70s. They don't really begin to understand what we're talking about here. And the bad news in that is, if you are great money and if you are globally minded, you can pick and choose. And you will choose where you can win. You will choose where the least odds of getting hurt by corruption and top-down problems are. You certainly will invest where you know you can get your money out. And I think the biggest weight in many respects to the phenomena we live in right now is that a lot of top-down institutions don't know what they're holding back. And of course, the most saddest ramifications, if they really hold back talent, talent is mobile and talent will move to places where it can succeed. And then, of course, that becomes a cycle of its own.
That's interesting. And I think even further in a time of a pandemic, right, talent is more universal than ever. I mean, everyone can work remotely right now. I think there's no stopping us from going to where the talent lies to really succeed as a company. Really love that insight. Marina, take us home here with a last question for Chris. And, you know, I think we need to respect his time here as we wrap up today.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, I have a very good question for you, Chris, and I hope you find it as good as I do. But as we look at deals in Asia and in North America, like you mentioned about the legacy system that do not change, especially financial institutions, for example, I think this is very anchored into deep down legacy system. But there are in Asia, especially regulated part, for example, in medical place or labor, that evolved very quickly compared to the U.S., where in the U.S., you know, changing the medical system, it's a question that's been over the table for at least decades. And I am kind of wondering, like, what do you think of Asian country innovating in spaces where regulations are more flexible than in the U.S.? Do you see it being, I don't want to see a threat to the U.S. market, but do you see being like leaders in innovation in the future?
I think the phenomenon you're talking about is some of the greatest examples that everyone can learn from, including the West. I mean, obviously, Singapore has been this way for a long time. Other places like Taiwan have had elements of it. But I tell people, and they don't believe me when I say it, that I have watched, and these are early days, but it's been very encouraging, regulators in Indonesia work side by side with venture capitalists and with entrepreneurs to really genuinely see if we can figure out how to make regulation right. What can we do, in fact, to not build a legacy system or to protect only existing businesses, but at the same time, what can we do to really unleash financial inclusion across Indonesia with many multiplier ramifications of that. Now, in any government circumstance, there's always going to be an element of legacy wanting to try to block it and lobby against it and whatever. But to your point, I'm seeing not only in Asia, this is actually, you know, of all places, you've been true somewhat in Brazil, you know, the UAE, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi have leaned incredibly forward in ways that you do not see in the United States of America right now in trying to embrace and make an environment safer for entrepreneurs and innovation to succeed, whether that innovation comes from their backyard or also becoming a catcher's mitt, effectively, of talent anywhere, who come to us, come build here. If you think you've got frustrations in San Francisco right now, we'll take those frustrations away from you. And I think my broader observation is that the governments who get that right, Estonia, Singapore, and others, are going to be leaders in the 21st century and are clear models for other countries to understand and study without hopefully any hubris or arrogance, and to realize that there are lessons to be had here. The ones who ignore it or the ones who are complacent upon them will put themselves at competitive disadvantage. It is a very painful time in America right now, and it's a much whole longer conversation to have about the relationship between the United States and China right now. But there's absolutely unarguable that there are things that are also done positively in China, not only because there's unbelievable talent innovation that has been unleashed now at a massive scale, but then, lo and behold, this isn't some description of what China was like 20 years from now. This is a country that's literally trying to figure out how this innovation can be unleashed, how corruption can be addressed. And we should be humble and open enough to say, if it works, we ought to think about it. I don't care where it comes from. And if it doesn't work, obviously, we'll do something different. But the examples, in the same way that great entrepreneurs are coming anywhere, some of the examples are coming from places that many people in the West really don't think about at all. And shame on us.
Awesome. Thanks for that. Great. Well, Chris, any last words before we wrap up here today? But really, thank you for your time. For those who joined us in and out, you know, we were talking all about the global entrepreneurial revolution where innovation is happening in some of the unexpected places and during an unexpected time of a pandemic. Chris, last words as we wrap up here today.
Just keep doing what you're doing. I mean, I know some of the people who've been in this room in and out, and there are other people whose bios I've seen. And I think you folk guys are the vanguard of helping to create bottom-up a very, very different world. And this will be an exciting thing. It can be. I think we're living in an age of wonder in these tools that we have. I think they embed on us tremendous responsibility to use these tools smartly and safely and openly, because as I started the earlier part of the conversation, there are many people who are not benefiting from these tools as yet. But that is the challenge to an entrepreneur. There are things in our teeth that we can solve now in ways that we couldn't discuss even 5 or 10 years ago. And it's our choice whether we step up or do not.
Absolutely. And I just want to end with something a good friend often reminds me. You know, a lot of times, sometimes as entrepreneurs, it can feel lonely. It can feel like we're working in silos, even as GPs of funds, you know, working in our silos. But and to think sometimes we may not have the power to really change things. But the easiest way, as I was told, you know, that to give away power is to believe that we have none. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to lead forward as entrepreneurs, as VCs. And I see a lot of, you know, some big check writers here who are tuning in. I see you. So, you know, keep leading forward. And thank you for tuning in to this important conversation.
And thanks so much for tuning in this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow our socials at Sarah Chen Global to get the latest news on the show. I'm Sarah Chen, and you've been listening to Billion Dollar Moves.